Good morning. This is Press Watch on KBOO Portland. It's 9:31. I'm Teresa Mitchell, here with news and opinion.
Sylvia, whatever my last name is.
You haven't decided?
No, I haven't decided.
How about Maya?
No.
Okay, Sylvia whatever.
Sylvia Hawk.
Okay. And we've got a few things to talk about. The way I see it, the whole idea with the neocon coup, how do you say it? Neocon? Neocon coup of 2000 was that the pro-corporate elites would all collaborate so that a sort of new World War II era would arise in the minds of the U.S. population. I'm not talking about an actual reproduction of World War II, but rather a misty-eyed Hollywood zeitgeist which would result in an extended period of fearful and absolute obedience. And it seems to me that the plan worked very well for a while, so well that mentioning the bizarre interceptor stand-down on 9/11/01 seems disloyal and questionable, and pointing out that no investigation ever took place of the crime scene, that the evidence was carted off immediately and designated as strictly off-limits seems conspiratorial and ungrateful. I've mentioned before, I think, that on that day I felt a great foreboding and burden, as did my spouse. We battled the spin control all that afternoon, along with many others at this little radio station, but in the evening we went to a local bar that supported television sets, showing those buildings doing their insane demolition de-erections, and we got very drunk. I'm not ashamed to say that I went and got drunk in response. I felt utterly defeated, swept aside, and full of grief for the whole American social fabric. I felt it in my gut that it was a Reichstag fire, though I didn't use that formulation at the time, and I know I wasn't the only one. Let me draw your remembrance painfully to the hysteria which followed, in which the corporate-owned media outlets bellowed that a new time of unquestioning allegiance had arrived and that all must bow before it or be branded collaborators with a terrifying and nebulous enemy. That's capital E, enemy. Anthrax was mailed to Democrats. Everyone bought Cipro and looked at their hands for black patches. Fire departments were called out for every unmonitored spill of sugar or flour, and the FBI managed to carefully avoid actually investigating the perpetrators. The culture wars followed as our great leaders insisted that we punish gays and lesbians by taking away their rights, my rights. Yes, these things actually happened, to our lasting shame, though the greater shame was to follow as the Cheney-Bush axis took us by the blindfolds and led us to war against an imaginary threat. Thousands of deaths took our soldiers, and tens and hundreds of thousands died in the war zones, and all of the soldiers and Afghanis and Iraqis who were within sniffing distance of our poisonous, depleted uranium munitions are destined to die an early death. On September 11, 2001, I could not drink enough liquor to drown the feeling of doom, not for New York or the Pentagon, frankly, which I knew would survive. I felt the doom of the hope for a post-Cold War renaissance. Remember that hope? It's painful to mention it now. It's gone for the moment. Over the horizon, a silly utopian dream rather than a possible path, or so it seems. But now the great juggernaut of lies has faltered, and its colossus of video screens and tank treads has almost creaked to a shuddering halt. The ground beneath us shakes as the neocons falter. Tom DeLay Maccabeus is hammering out plausible denials rather than new draconian laws. 12 co-conspirators of corruption await a sealed indictment to be revealed in March to show how their bank accounts swell with Jack Abramoff's ill-gained dollars. And are they Republicans? Oh, yeah. A woman has appeared in the wilderness outside the Bush Dandy Ranch, demanding an accounting for the blood of her son, and the masses groan with sympathy and rage. A revived anti-war movement is finding ground. Cheney clings to life and shuffles between islands of sympathy and seclusion. George the Lesser has been insulted and weakened by even the corporate polling machines. The evidence of electoral fraud grows stronger by the day, and even conformists, though they won't admit it, must begin to worry that their vote may not count, that the elections may be a charade after all. The Republicans and their collaborators have begun to realize that they have not only crossed the Rubicon River but have burned all the bridges, that their legitimacy is leaking out like water from a punctured radiator, leading to an ineluctable prison sentence for some and an ignominious and dwindling fortune for the rest. Some of them may feel panic coming on, but there are others who wish to stay the course, a course of deceptions and death and war. They feel the masses can again be frightened into their cattle pen. They plan to fly the whole 9/11 agenda again. How do I know that? I just feel it. They want to do it again, this time with feeling, and they have put Iran and Syria into their crosshairs. Now is our time to strike. This moment will not last. The momentum can be easily lost. We cannot hesitate or falter. The fascists know their destination or think they do, and they know or will soon realize that their only hope lies in a bloody police state, a complete erasure of accountability and democratic control so that their many sins and omissions may pass beneath the clouds of war and totalitarianism and be forgotten or at least subject to omerta. It is that or the prison door for them, and it is our choice, too, to speak up now and deny legitimacy to the usual lies and blandishments, even to our families, even to our coworkers, to say that the war is wrong, even to the warriors and their families, to point out that the Bush administration is a fascist coup and illegitimate, to demand international inspectors and paper ballots for our elections, to force a cessation and reversal of global warming. And that is just the beginning, and a long way from the lost Cold War peace benefit, but is far preferable to silence, to a life of fear and restrictions and lies. Each of us must choose now to fight fascism with every fiber of our beings, or to lose our freedoms and prosperity and health to the corporate elite. So, which is better? Shall we fight, or shall we fade into misery? This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's gay and lesbian community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or www.pdxgayyellowpages.com. I'm joined here by Miss Sylvia.
Hi.
And I've asked her to pass along an article from Al Jazeera. And the reason I've brought this article is that this writer really takes something of a collaborationist attitude with the American military and always has, but this is a regular contributor to Al Jazeera. And so when you hear that Al Jazeera is uniformly anti-American, or that they are in fact in some greater sense anti-American, I think this sort of thing belies it. And really, you should pull up their English website for two reasons. One, to see for yourself that it's just a news source, and it's not aligned with the Americans. It's a Muslim news source, and it's a good one, and, well, for certain things. Somewhat corporatist, frankly. It's centered in Oman, belongs to the Sultanate of Oman, which is, technically at least, a U.S. ally. And the second reason for pulling up Al Jazeera is people like me who pull up Al Jazeera need you to dilute and expand the number of people who pull it up so that the snoop lists that we all know are being kept become less useful. There's a patriotic duty for you. So this is by Sandy, what's
Sandy Shanks.
Sandy Shanks, writing for Al Jazeera.
This is a sad admission for an advocate of the third option, an all-out effort to help the Iraqi people by eliminating the evil forces America unleashed in Iraq. The writing is on the wall. The American people are already being prepped for withdrawal, which equates to defeat for Americans and Iraqis alike, any way you look at it. American resolve is not being weakened by those who wish a precipitate withdrawal of American forces from Iraq. American resolve and our military leadership are endangered by the President of the United States. Speaking before a friendly audience at the Annapolis Naval Academy, an audience that included current and future tactical and strategic planners, President Bush provided a unique strategy for victory in a beleaguered nation weary of decades of war and murderous dictatorial rule.
What are those dictatorial rule things?
Dictatorial rule things, yes. According to the president, our mission in Iraq is to win the war. We will continue to shift from providing security and conducting operations against the enemy nationwide to conducting more specialized operations targeted at the most dangerous terrorists. We will increasingly move out of Iraqi cities and reduce the number of bases from which we operate and conduct fewer patrols and convoys. Ignoring for the moment that we are not fighting terrorists, but Iraqis, members of the Sunni Arab Resistance, Al-Qaeda of Iraq notwithstanding, as a student of military history, never have I heard such an ignominious strategy for victory, end quotes. In view of this address, my heart goes out to Marines, soldiers, sailors, and their officers who are trying their level best to bring security to Iraq and are then undercut by their commander-in-chief. The same could be said for the Iraqi security forces who may be abandoned prematurely. It has been suggested that the president was referring to some future time when Iraqi security forces would assume those responsibilities being abrogated by Americans. That may not be too far off for President Bush to consider now, noting that he was using present tense, not future tense. Speaking before the Senate Armed Forces Committee on 30th September, General George W. Casey, Jr., who oversees U.S. forces in Iraq, informed the senators that there are fewer Iraqi battalions at, quote, level one, unquote, readiness than there were a few months ago. That the number of Iraqi army battalions that can fight insurgents without U.S. and coalition help has dropped from 3 to 1. Noting the negative progress, I am unaware of any update on this critical matter. More recently, Gary Schmidt, Director of Strategic Studies at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, told the Los Angeles Times that while some Iraqi units have improved, quote, to get a force that is really effective requires a lot more experience than this army is likely to have for years, unquote. Writing in the Atlantic Monthly, James Follows reports, time and again, since the training began, inspection teams have visited Iraq and come to the same conclusion. The readiness of many Iraqi units is low, their loyalty and morale are questionable, regional and ethnic divisions are sharp, and their reported numbers overstate the real effectiveness, unquote. For the first time, I greatly fear the outcome of this war. Bush's address to the Annapolis audience creates the identical scenario, overstating our allies' capabilities while underestimating the abilities of our antagonists that many experienced during the Vietnamese War. For the very first time, a realization is setting in that this war could be lost. Such a fate would be as a direct result of the actions of the president who put the troops there in the first place, only to lose. The pure irony of this impending defeat is not it being caused by the withdraw now crowd or the more moderate set a timetable bunch, both of which draws the ire of Bush, Cheney, and company, but it is being caused by Bush, Cheney, and company. That didn't make much sense to me. Anyway, there is little doubt that America invaded Iraq for all the wrong reasons. That Saddam was allied with Al-Qaeda and somehow involved with 9/11 was ludicrous. That Saddam had WMDs, which he intended to threaten the civilized world, is not so ludicrous, but proven untrue. That aside, nearly 3 years later, now the goal is to create a free Iraq, a worthy goal, which should not be marginalized.
And that's where I wanted to interrupt. Sylvie's reading the words of Sandy Shanks in Al Jazeera, and that's where I say that Sandy is a collaborationist. And you might want to read part of the rest of that in a second there, Syl. But the idea that Americans are responsible for the freedoms of Iraqis is odiously hypocritical. And the only reason people don't recognize it as hypocritical is that we've become inured to it, that this idea has been presented to us as legitimate so many times that we just let it slide by, and it's ridiculous. I mean, as the writer points out, this nation invaded that nation, uninvited, and without cause, simply without cause. And the horror that we have unleashed on that place is unmitigated by the sincere and industrious efforts of our troops who have been set about the task of trying to win the support of the population without support, material support from the Bush administration. They've been set about an impossible task, and they die for it, and that, too, is odious. But if the Iraqis are to be free, then they should have their very first freedom, which is to be free from invaders and to be free from the destruction and the enduring devastation of the invasion, and that means war reparations, and they will be, and they should be very expensive because we have sprayed depleted uranium all over the place. And if there could be a third party, and I don't know that there could if we were to respect the UN's ideals of sovereignty and peace, but if there were to be a third party involved in restoring the freedom of Iraqis or creating the freedom of Iraqis or whatever, it would be the UN or the Red Crescent or someone acceptable, but certainly it would not be the invaders who have destroyed the country. It doesn't matter how sincere or how devoted to the flag or how duty conscious our soldiers are, is not appropriate that they should be there at all. And so that's, you know, getting back to the point, this is on Al Jazeera and this is a collaborationist attitude, and it's so pervasive that it is even on Al Jazeera. But we should rid ourselves of it. You know, if it's in anyone's mind that the U.S. has a legitimate role to play in Iraq, we don't. We don't have any legitimate role to play in Iraq, period. We're simply war criminals as far as Iraq is concerned, and we all share some of the guilt for that. But I wonder if you could pick up where you left off there, Syl.
Sure. Moreover, it being the goal to create a free Iraq is a goal desired by many Iraqis yearning for freedom. Unfortunately, the euphoria of the elections on 15th December is now over, and it is time now to get down to the serious business of creating an effective government in Iraq, because freedom is not a given with mere free elections. Furthermore, it is virtually impossible for a government to work amid violence, death, and destruction. It is understood that the majority of Iraqis want the Americans to leave. That wish is shared by the majority of Americans.
And there's more to read on that, and if you want to read that article, that was not even half of it, I think, and it's at Al Jazeera English. And you pull that up at english.aljazeera.net, and then you'll see the opinion, icon to click on, and you can get that article by Sandy Shanks. But I wanted to read that. I wanted Sylvie to read that last part because it just gets further into that hypocrisy. Even though the writer gets everything except that hypocrisy, and just can't seem to accept the idea that, you know, the U.S. needs to butt out and pay the war reparations. And I have yet to hear the term war reparations anywhere. But on my own program, I don't know anyone who is calling for war reparations, and I don't see why not. If our war was illegitimate, then we pull out and we pay war reparations. What's wrong with that? How could it be otherwise? Well, changing subjects somewhat, Samuel Alito is up before Congress combined, and there's been a lot to say about his dodginess and stodginess and his cleverness. The guy's obviously smart, but he was selected by the Bush administration, and therefore he must advance their agenda, and their agenda is monstrous, and we know that no matter how he dodges, he is not someone who is legitimately concerned with the freedoms of Americans, but rather the maintenance of power in the Bush-Cheney mold. And so I pulled up the Attitude blog, that's spelled A-T-T-Y-T-O-O-D if you want to look it up, and the posting on the 10th of this month is titled, He Can't Handle the Truth, The Real Story of Sam Alito, ROTC and the Concerned Alumni of Princeton. And the Attitude blog writer writes, the Samuel Alito confirmations hearings droned on, but there was one moment this morning that really stopped us in our tracks, his bizarre explanation for the reason why he joined the ultra-conservative, anti-affirmative action Concerned Alumni of Princeton, or CAP, around the time he graduated from the Ivy League school in 72. Carried the overpowering whiff of baloney the second we heard it. We won't accuse the Supreme Court wannabe of lying because we can't know what's in Sam Alito's brain or his heart. But his explanation that he was motivated by his anger over student protests against the ROTC where he was an officer simply does not jibe with either the facts or the accounts of his Princeton contemporaries. As you may have heard, Alito boasted of his membership in the CAP group in a 1985 application seeking a job in the Reagan administration. That set off some alarm bells back at Princeton because CAP had been quite a controversial group. The first issue of its magazine, Prospect, published just before Alito graduated, contained articles bashing the growing number of blacks and women on campus, and CAP would later publish even more strident material against gays and others. Today, Alito, under questioning from Vermont Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy, we're actually talking about a couple of days ago, the 10th, insisted he can't really recall any role in the group and offered this explanation for why he might have been associated, and this is quoting Alito, and the issue that had rankled me about Princeton for some time was the issue of the ROTC. I was in ROTC, that's Reserve Officer Training Corps, when I was in Princeton, and the unit was expelled from campus, and I thought that was very wrong. I had a lot of friends who were against the war in Vietnam, and I respected their opinions, but I didn't think that it was right to oppose the military for that reason. And the issue, although the Army unit was eventually brought back, the Navy and Air Force units did not come back, and the issue kept coming up, and there were people who were strongly opposed to having any unit on campus, and the attitude seemed to be that the military was the bad institution, and that Princeton was too good for the military, and that Princeton would somehow be sullied if people in uniform were walking around the campus, that the courses didn't merit getting credit, that the instructors shouldn't be viewed as part of the faculty. And that was the issue that bothered me about that, end quote. That's a quote of Alito in the Attitude blog. And Attitude writes, Alito's explanation doesn't add up. You know, I really don't know who writes the Attitude blog. I looked for it, and I just, you know, I guess I was sleepy. I didn't find it. And here's why. Samuel Alito joined the ROTC at Princeton for one reason. I like to say ROTC rhymes with Nazi. And that's the way I experienced him when I was in school. But anyway, getting back to the blog. And for one reason alone, so he wouldn't get killed in Vietnam. By 1969, Alito's sophomore year, the Selective Service had gone to the draft lottery system. and were preparing to end the system of educational deferments that had kept people like Alito out of the war. Alito's birthday, April 1st, 1950, came up number 32 that December, which all but guaranteed that the young Princetonian would be called up. But the ROTC was a way to avoid serving as cannon fodder on the front lines and possibly as a pathway to service in the Army Reserve, which, just like George W. Bush's service in the Texas Air National Guard, would have kept Alito out of the draft and away from the steamy, lethal jungles of the Mekong Delta. So in 1970, right after the lottery, young Sam Alito took a very sudden interest in military affairs. That summer, he attended a six-week training camp at Fort Knox, Kentucky, which was necessary to catch up with the 2 years of the ROTC program that he hadn't participated in. And friends say that the strong passion for the military he spoke of on the 10th simply did not exist. It was draft-related, college roommate Mark Dwyer said of Alito's decision. I joined the teacher preparation program. We were all focused on the draft lottery when those numbers got called. We thought about where we were. Sam looked like he was sure to be drafted. He said, if I'm going into the Army, I might as well be an officer, end quote. Then there's this. The war was a subject of some conversation on campus, but I think we tended to talk more about what was going on in our classes. We didn't talk much about politics, end quote, and that's from a co-classmate named G-R-A-I-S, don't know how to pronounce it. Dwyer did not recall Alito ever defending the Vietnam War or even wearing his ROTC uniform except during the couple of hours per week that he had to attend training. So, there's that about Alito, and there's more at the Attitude blog, A-T-T-Y-T-O-O-D.
I have a question.
Okay.
Who's this guy and why do we care? I mean, it's obnoxious and kind of disgusting, but...
Alito?
Yeah.
He's going through confirmation hearings in the combined houses of Congress to be the Supreme He's going to be on the Supreme Court. Now I can't think of the term. Supreme Court Justice. He'll be the top dog there. What's the top dog called? Wow, that's a blank. Gosh, let me check. What's my name? It's Teresa Mitchell, and you're listening to Press Watch on KBOO. I can remember that. Gee, that's a real blank. Oh, well, anyway. Earlier, I mentioned, now I'm going to change the topic again, forgive me, but earlier I mentioned depleted uranium in my rant against the Iraq War and against the Bush administration's plans hinting at, I think they want to go to war with Iran and maybe Syria first and just, you know, generally blow up things and scare us. And I mentioned depleted uranium, and I don't think there's been nearly enough reporting on what depleted uranium is doing. An expert report warning that the long-term health of Iraqi civilian population would be endangered by British and U.S. depleted uranium weapons has been kept secret. This is according to the British Sunday Herald. You can find it at sundayherald.com. This is by Rob Edwards, the environment editor. The study by three leading radiation scientists cautioned that children and adults could contract cancer after breathing in dust containing DU, which is radioactive and chemically toxic. But it was blocked from publication by the World Health Organization, which employed the main author, Dr. Keith Baverstock, as a senior radiation advisor. He alleges that it was deliberately suppressed, though this is denied by the World Health Organization.
Baverstock also believes that if the study had been published when it was completed in 2001, there would have been more pressure on the U.S. and U.K. to limit their use of depleted uranium weapons in last year's war and to clean up afterwards. Hundreds of thousands of depleted uranium shells were fired by coalition tanks and planes during the conflict, and there has been no comprehensive decontamination. Experts from the United Nations Environment Program, or UNEP, have so far not been allowed into Iraq to assess the pollution. Baverstock tells the Sunday Herald that our study suggests that the widespread use of depleted uranium weapons in Iraq could pose a unique health hazard to the civilian population. He continues, there is increasing scientific evidence the radioactivity and the chemical toxicity of depleted uranium could cause more damage to human cells than is assumed. Baverstock was the World Health Organization's top expert on radiation and health for 11 years until he retired in May last year. He now works with the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Kuopio in Finland, I'm sure I mutilated that, and was recently appointed to the UK government's newly formed Committee on Radioactive Waste Management. While he was a member of staff, the World Health Organization refused to give him permission to publish the study, which was co-authored by Professor Carmel Mothersill from McMaster University in Canada and Dr. Mike Thorne, a radiation consultant. Baverstock suspects that the World Health Organization was leaned on by a more powerful pro-nuclear UN body.
Gee, I wonder who that would be.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, or the IAEA.
IAEA, I like that.
IAEA.
Being monitored by the...
Quote, I believe our study was censored and suppressed by the World Health Organization because they didn't like its conclusions. Previous experience suggests that World Health Organization officials were bowing to pressure from the IAEA, whose remit is to promote the nuclear power, unquote, he said. He continues, that is more than unfortunate, as publishing the study would have helped forewarn the authorities on the risks of using depleted uranium weapons in Iraq. These allegations, however, are dismissed as totally unfounded by the World Health Organization.
And, which is weird, if you ask me. I mean, there's no doubt about what depleted uranium does. I mean, there's so much obfuscation about it. For one thing, it's... The word depleted is certainly deceptive. The stuff is it's leftover uranium from nuclear reactors. It's been sitting there emitting radiation and changing itself due to the nature of that radiation, specifically gamma, and breaking itself into daughter products. It's contaminated with its own, thus, radioactive activity. It's contaminated with other metals, which then become radioactive through its exposure to it. But it's dangerous enough, even if it were pure, which it's not, because it's an alpha emitter. And if you get, as Dr. John Goffman has pointed out, Dr. John Goffman of Nobel Prize recipient has pointed out, it only takes 1/40,000th of an ounce of an alpha-emitting transuranic like that. Actually, it's not a transuranic, but uranium or a transuranic, which emits an alpha particle. It only takes 1/40,000th of an ounce, and that's a really microscopic amount, to cause cancer, because the stuff just sits there and ticks off those little alpha particles until it breaks a chromosome. It's not strong enough to create a cyst in the lungs like a gamma emitter would be. It doesn't destroy tissue to that degree. It's much more subtle, and so it's guaranteed. It just sits there until it causes cancer. It just, you know, it's pretty much guaranteed because it sits there in your lung. And it just messes with those chromosomes until something bad happens.
Right. Gamma radiation can go through a lead wall, but alpha radiation can definitely go through your skin. The term pure.
Well, alpha can be stopped by a sheet of paper.
Okay, I didn't know that. Yeah. I'm a chemistry student. Anyway, shall I continue?
Yes, please.
Oh, great. Where was I? We'll just continue. A Baversock study, which has now been passed to the Sunday Herald, pointed out that Iraq's arid climate meant that tiny particles of depleted uranium were likely to be blown around and inhaled by civilians for years to come. It warned that, when inside the body, their radiation and toxicity could trigger the growth of malignant tumors. The study suggested that the low-level radiation from depleted uranium could harm cells adjacent to those that are directly irradiated, a phenomenon known as the bystander effect. This undermines the stability of the body's genetic system and is thought by many scientists to be linked to cancers and possibly other illnesses.
You know, I didn't know. That's the first I've read about that. Something new about that. We are almost out of time, so I want to comment that I've been joined by Sylvia Maya Hawk-Mitchell, or Sylvia Hawk, and it's getting around to 10 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Radio, and before I go... I wanted to say that the rant that I started this program with can be found at presswatch.blogspot.com. And I wonder if you have anything on your mind.
Not especially, no.
Not especially? Okay, well, thanks for helping read and for your comments. And thank you for listening to Press Watch. And please stay tuned for more of the incomparable Radio Zine on KBOO Portland.
Hi, I'm J.J. Johnson, the host of Jay's Place on KBOO Radio. I would like to invite you to the Martin Luther King Celebration, Friday, January 13th, and again on Monday, the 16th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. We'll have street interviews. You can call in and give your opinions live on air about the Civil Rights Movement and Dr. King. Listen to great gospel music and hear some of Dr. King's famous speeches, I Have a Dream, On the Mountaintop, and more. So tune in Friday, January the 13th, and Monday, January the 16th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., and help us celebrate Dr. King's life. This is why we say we want to be your community voice and your musical choice.